21. The next day, Monday, Todd was up at 6 o'clock in the morning and poking listlessly at a scrambled egg he had fixed for himself, when his father came down, still dressed in his monogrammed bathrobe and slippers. He said to Todd, going past him to the refrigerator for orange juice. Todd grunted back without looking up from his book, one of the 87th Squad mysteries. He had been lucky enough to land a summer job with a landscaping outfit that operated out of Pasadena. That would have been much too far to commute ordinarily, even if one of his parents had been willing to loan him a car for the summer. Neither was. But his father was working on-site not far from there, and he was able to drop Todd off at a bus stop on his way and pick him up at the same place on his way back. Todd was less than wild about the arrangement. He didn't like riding home from work with his father, and he absolutely detested riding to work with him in the morning. It was in the mornings that he felt the most naked, and the wall between what he was and what he might be seemed the thinnest. It was worse after a night of bad dreams. But even if no dreams had come in the night, it was bad. One morning he realized with a fright so suddenly it was almost terror that he had been seriously considering reaching across his father's briefcase, grabbing the wheel of the Porsche and sending them corkscrewing into the two express lanes, cutting a swath of destruction through the morning commuters. "You want another egg, Toto?" "No, thanks, Dad." Dick Bowden ate them fried. How could anyone stand to eat a fried egg? On the grill of the Gen Air for 2 minutes, then over easy. What you got on your plate at the end looked like a giant dead eye with a cataract over it. An eye that would bleed orange when you poked it with your fork. He pushed his scrambled egg away and barely touched it. Outside, the morning paper slapped the step. His father finished cooking, turned off the grill, and came to the table. "Not hungry this morning, Taro?" "You call me that one more time and I'm going to stick my knife right up your fucking nose, Daddo." Not much appetite, I guess. Dick grinned affectionately at his son. There was still a tiny dab of shaving cream on the boy's right ear. "Betty Trask stole your appetite, that's my guess." "Yeah, maybe that's it." He offered a wan smile that vanished as soon as his father went down the stairs from the breakfast nook to get the paper. "Would it wake you up if I told you what a cunt she is, Daddo? How about if I said, 'Oh, by the way, did you know your good friend Ray Trask's daughter is one of the biggest sluts in San Donato? She'd kiss her own twat if she was double-jointed, Daddo. That's how much she thinks of it. Just a stinking little slut. Two lines of coke and she's yours for the night. And if you don't happen to have any coke, she's still yours for the night. She'd fuck a dog if she couldn't get a man. Think that'd wake you up, Daddo? Get you a flying start on the day?'" He pushed the thoughts back away viciously, knowing they wouldn't stay gone. His father came back with the paper. Todd glimpsed the headline, "Space Shuttle Won't Fly, Expert Says." Dick sat down. "Betty's a fine-looking girl," he said. "She reminds me of your mother when I first met her." "Is that so?" "Pretty, young, fresh." Dick Bowden's eyes had gone vague. Now they came back, focusing almost anxiously on his son. "Not that your mother isn't still a fine-looking woman, but at that age a girl has a certain glow, I guess you'd say. It's there for a while, and it's gone." He shrugged and opened the paper. "C'est la vie, I guess. She's a bitch in heat. Maybe that's what makes her glow." "You're treating her right, aren't you, Toto?" His father was making his usual rapid trip through the paper toward the sports pages. "Not getting too fresh?" "Everything's cool, Dad. If he doesn't stop pretty soon, I'll do something. Scream, throw his coffee in his face, something." "Ray thinks you're a fine boy," Dick said absently. He had at last reached the sports. He became absorbed. There was blessed silence at the breakfast table. Betty Trask had been all over him the very first time they went out. He had taken her to the local Lover's Lane after the movie because he knew it would be expected of him. They could swap spits for half an hour or so and have all the right things to tell their respective friends the next day. She could roll her eyes and tell how she had fought off his advances. Boys were so tiresome, really, and she never fucked on the first date. She wasn't that kind of girl. Her friends would agree, and then all of them would troop into the girls' room and do whatever it was they did in there, put on fresh makeup, smoke Tampax, whatever. And for a guy, well, you had to make out. You had to get at least to second base and try for third, because there were reputations and reputations. Todd couldn't have cared less about having a stud reputation. He only wanted a reputation for being normal. And if you didn't at least try, word got around. People started to wonder if you were all right. So he took them up on Jane's Hill, kissed them, felt their tits, went a little further than that if they would allow it. And that was it. The girl would stop him, he would put up a little good-natured argument, and then take her home. No worries about what might be said in the girls' room the next day. No worries that anyone was going to think Todd Bowden was anything but normal. Except Betty Trask was the kind of girl who fucked on the first date. On every date. And in between dates. The first time had been a month or so before the goddamn Nazi's heart attack, and Todd thought he had done pretty well for a virgin. Perhaps for the same reason a young pitcher will do well if he's tapped to throw the biggest game of the year with no forewarning. There had been no time to worry, to get all strung up about it. Always before, Todd had been able to sense when a girl had made up her mind that on the next date she would just allow herself to be carried away. He was aware that he was personable and that both his looks and his prospects were good, the kind of boy their cunty mothers regarded as a good catch. And when he sensed that physical capitulation about to happen, he would start dating some other girl. And whatever it said about his personality, Todd was able to admit to himself that if he ever started dating a truly frigid girl, he would probably be happy to date her for years to come. Maybe even marry her. But the first time with Betty had gone fairly well. She was no virgin, even if he was. She had to help him get his cock into her, but she seemed to take that as a matter of course. And halfway through the act itself, she had gurgled up from the blanket they were lying on, "I just love to fuck." It was the tone of voice another girl might have used to express her love for strawberry whirl ice cream. Later encounters, there had been five of them, five and a half, he supposed, if he wanted to count last night, hadn't been so good. They had, in fact, gotten worse at what seemed an exponential rate, although he didn't believe even now that Betty had been aware of that. At least not until last night. In fact, quite the opposite. Betty apparently believed she had found the battering ram of her dreams. Todd hadn't felt any of the things he was supposed to feel at a time like that. Kissing her lips was like kissing warm but uncooked liver. Having her tongue in his mouth only made him wonder what kind of germs she was carrying. And sometimes he thought he could smell her fillings, an unpleasant metallic odor like chrome. Her breasts were bags of meat, no more. Todd had done it twice more with her before Dusander's heart attack. Each time he had more trouble getting erect. In both cases, he had finally succeeded by using a fantasy. She was stripped naked in front of all their friends, crying. Todd was forcing her to walk up and down before them while he cried out, "Show your tits! Let 'em see your snatch, you cheap slut! Spread your cheeks! That's right, bend over and spread 'em!" Betty's appreciation was not at all surprising. He was a good lover, not in spite of his problems, but because of them. Getting hard was only the first step. Once you achieved erection, you had to have an orgasm. The fourth time they had done it, this was 3 days after Dusander's heart attack, he had pounded away at her for over 10 minutes. Betty Trask thought she had died and gone to heaven. She had 3 orgasms and was trying for a fourth when Todd recalled an old fantasy. What was, in fact, the first fantasy. The girl on the table, clamped and helpless, the huge dildo, the rubber squeeze bulb. Only now, desperate and sweaty and almost insane with his desire to come and get this horror over with, the face of the girl on the table became Betty's face. That brought on a joyless, rubbery spasm that he supposed was technically at least an orgasm. A moment later, Betty was whispering in his ear, her breath warm and redolent of juicy fruit gum. "Lover, you do me any old time. Just call me." Todd had nearly groaned aloud. The nub of his dilemma was this. Wouldn't his reputation suffer if he broke off with the girl who so obviously wanted to put out for him? Wouldn't people wonder why? Part of him said they would not. He remembered walking down the hall behind 2 senior boys during his freshman year and hearing one of them tell the other he had broken off with his girlfriend. The other wanted to know why. "Fucked her out," the first said, and both of them bellowed goatish laughter. "If someone asks me why I dropped her, I'll just say I fucked her out. But what if she says we only did it 5 times? Is that enough?" "What? How much? How many?" "Who'll talk? What'll they say?" So his mind ran on, as restless as a hungry rat in an insoluble maze. He was vaguely aware that he was turning a minor problem into a big problem, and that this very inability to solve the problem had something to say about how shaky he had gotten, But knowing it brought him no fresh ability to change his behavior, and he sank into a black depression. College. College was the answer. College offered an excuse to break with Betty that no one could question. But September seemed so far away. The fifth time it had taken him almost 20 minutes to get hard, but Betty had proclaimed the experience well worth the wait, and then last night he hadn't been able to perform at all. "What are you, anyway?" Betty had asked petulantly. After 20 minutes of manipulating his lax penis, she was disheveled and out of patience. "Are you one of those AC/DC guys?" He very nearly strangled her on the spot. And if he had his 30-30, "Well, I'll be a son of a gun! Congratulations, son!" "Huh?" He looked up and out of his black study. "You made the Southern Cal High School All-Stars." His father was grinning with pride and pleasure. "Is that so?" For a moment he hardly knew what his father was talking about. He had to grope for the meaning of the words. "Oh, say, yeah. Coach Haynes mentioned something to me about that at the end of the year. Said he was putting me and Billy DeLyons up. I never expected anything to happen." "Well, Jesus, you don't seem very excited about it." "Still trying. Who gives a ripe fuck? To get used to the idea." With a huge effort, he managed to grin. "Can I see the article?" His father handed the paper across the table to Todd and got to his feet. "I'm going to wake Monica up. She's got to see this before we leave." "No, God, I can't face both of them this morning." "Aw, don't do that. You know she won't be able to get back to sleep if you wake her. We'll leave it for her on the table." "Yeah, I suppose we could do that. You're a damn thoughtful boy, Todd." He clapped Todd on the back, and Todd squeezed his eyes closed. At the same time, he shrugged his shoulders in an aw-shucks gesture that made his father laugh. Todd opened his eyes again and looked at the paper. "Four boys named to Southern Cal All-Stars," the headline read. Beneath were pictures of them in their uniforms. The catcher and left fielder from Fairview High, the harp southpaw from Mountford, and Todd to the far right, grinning openly out at the world from beneath the bill of his baseball cap. He read the story and saw that Billy DeLyons had made the second squad. That, at least, was something to feel happy about. DeLyons could claim he was a Methodist until his tongue fell out, if it made him feel good, but he wasn't fooling Todd. He knew perfectly well what Billy DeLyons was. Maybe he ought to introduce him to Betty Trask. She was another sheeny. He had wondered about that for a long time, and last night he had decided for sure. The Trasks were passing for white. One look at her nose and that olive complexion, her old man's was even worse, and you knew. That was probably why he hadn't been able to get it up. It was simple. His cock had known the difference before his brain. Who did they think they were kidding, calling themselves Trask? "Congratulations again, son." He looked up and first saw his father's hand stuck out, then his father's foolishly grinning face. "Your buddy Trask is a yid," he heard himself yelling into his father's face. "That's why I was impotent with his slut of a daughter last night. That's the reason." Then, on the heels of that, the cold voice that sometimes came at moments like this rose up from deep inside him, shutting off the rising flood of irrationality, as if, "Get hold of yourself right now." Behind steel gates. He took his father's hand and shook it. Smiled guilelessly into his father's proud face, said, "Geez, thanks, Dad." They left that page of the newspaper folded back, and a note for Monica, which Dick insisted Todd write and sign, "Your all-star son, Todd." 22. Ed French, a.k.a. Pucker French, a.k.a. Sneaker Pete and the Ked Man, also a.k.a. Rubber Ed French, was in the small and lovely seaside town of San Remo for a guidance counselor's convention. It was a waste of time, if ever there had been one. All guidance counselors could ever agree on was not to agree on anything. And he grew bored with the papers, seminars, and discussion periods after a single day. Halfway through the second day, he discovered he was also bored with San Remo, and that of the adjective small, lovely, and seaside. The key adjective was probably small. Gorgeous views and redwood trees aside, San Remo didn't have a movie theater or a bowling alley, and Ed hadn't wanted to go in the place's only bar. It had a dirt parking lot filled with pickup trucks, and most of the pickups had Reagan stickers on their rusty bumpers and tailgates. He wasn't afraid of being picked on, but he hadn't wanted to spend an evening looking at men in cowboy hats and listening to Loretta Lynn on the jukebox. So here he was on the third day of a convention which stretched out over an incredible 4 days. Here he was in room 217 of the Holiday Inn, his wife and daughter at home, the TV broken, an unpleasant smell hanging around in the bathroom. There was a swimming pool, but his eczema was so bad this summer that he wouldn't have been caught dead in a bathing suit. From the shins down, he looked like a leper. He had an hour before the next workshop helping the vocally challenged child. What they meant was doing something for kids who stuttered or who had cleft palates. But we wouldn't want to come right out and say that. Christ knows, someone might lower our salaries. He had eaten lunch at San Remo's only restaurant. He didn't feel like a nap, and the TV's one station was showing a rerun of Bewitched. So he sat down with the telephone book and began to flip through it aimlessly, hardly aware of what he was doing, wondering distantly if he knew anyone crazy enough about either Small, Lovely, or Seaside to live in San Remo. He supposed this was what all the bored people in all the Holiday Inns all over the world ended up doing, looking for a forgotten friend or relative to call up on the phone. It was that, Bewitched, or the Gideon Bible, and if you did happen to get hold of somebody, what the hell did you say? Frank, how the hell are you? And by the way, which was it, Small, Lovely, or Seaside? Sure, right. Give that man a cigar and set him on fire. Yet, as he lay on the bed, flipping through the thin San Remo white pages and half-scanning the columns, it seemed to him that he did know somebody in San Remo. A book salesman? One of Sandra's nieces or nephews, of which there were marching battalions? A poker buddy from college? A relative of a student? That seemed to ring a bell, but he couldn't find it down any more tightly. He kept thumbing, and found he was sleepy after all. He had almost dozed off when it came to him, and he sat up, wide awake again. Lord Peter. They were rerunning those whimsy stories on PBS just lately, Clouds of Witness, Murder Must Advertise, The Nine Tailors. He and Sandra were hooked. A man named Ian Carmichael played whimsy, and Sandra was nuts for him. So nuts, in fact, that Ed, who didn't think Carmichael looked like Lord Peter at all, actually became quite irritated. Sandy, the shape of his face is all wrong, and he's wearing false teeth, for heaven's sake. Pooh, Sandra had replied airily from the couch where she was curled up. You're just jealous. He's so handsome. Daddy's jealous, Daddy's jealous, little Norma sang, prancing around the living room in her duck pajamas. You should have been in bed an hour ago, Ed told her, gazing at his daughter with a jaundiced eye. And if I keep noticing you're here, I'll probably remember that you aren't there. Little Norma was momentarily abashed. Ed turned back to Sandra. I remember back 3 or 4 years ago I had a kid named Todd Bowden, and his grandfather came in for a conference. Now, that guy looked like Whimsy. A very old Whimsy, but the shape of his face was right, and Whimsy, Whimsy, Dimsy, Jimsy, little Norma sang. Whimsy, Bimsy, Doo-loo-loo. Shh, both of you, Sandra said. I think he's the most beautiful man. Irritating woman. But hadn't Todd Bowden's grandfather retired to San Remo? Sure, it had been on the forums. Todd had been one of the brightest boys in that year's class. Then, all at once, his grades had gone to hell. The old man had come in, told a familiar tale of marital difficulties, and had persuaded Ed to let the situation alone for a while and see if things didn't straighten themselves out. Ed's view was that the old laissez-faire bit didn't work. If you told a teenage kid to root, hog, or die, he or she usually died. But the old man had been almost eerily persuasive. It was the resemblance to Whimsy, perhaps. And Ed had agreed to give Todd to the end of the next flunk card period, and damned if Todd hadn't pulled through. The old man must have gone right through the whole family and really kicked some ass, Ed thought. He looked like the type who not only could do it, but who might derive a certain dour pleasure from it. Then, just 2 days ago, he had seen Todd's picture in the paper. He had made the Southern Cal All-Stars in baseball. No mean feat when you consider that about 500 boys were nominated each spring. He supposed he might never have come up with the grandfather's name if he hadn't seen the picture. He flicked through the white pages more purposefully now, ran his finger down a column of fine type, and there it was. Bowden Victor S., 403 Ridge Lane. Ed dialed the number, and it rang several times at the other end. He was just about to hang up when an old man answered. Hello? Hello, Mr. Bowden. Ed French from Santo Donato Junior High? Yes? Politeness, but no more. Certainly no recognition. Well, the old guy was 3 years further along, weren't they all, and things undoubtedly slipped his mind from time to time. "Do you remember me, sir?" "Should I?" Bowden's voice was cautious, and Ed smiled. The old man forgot things, but he didn't want anybody to know if he could help it. His own old man had been that way when his hearing started to go. "I was your grandson Todd's guidance counselor at SDJHS. I called to congratulate you. He sure tore up the pea patch when he got to high school, didn't he? And now he's all conference to top it off. Wow!" "Todd!" the old man said, his voice brightening immediately. "Yes, he certainly did a fine job, didn't he? Second in his class. And the girl who was ahead of him took the business courses," a sniff of disdain in the old man's voice. "My son called and offered to take me to Todd's commencement, but I'm in a wheelchair now. I broke my hip last January. I didn't want to go in a wheelchair. But I have his graduation picture right in the hall, you bet. Todd's made his parents very proud, and me, of course." "Yes, I guess we got him over the hump," Ed said. He was smiling as he said it, but his smile was a trifle puzzled. Somehow Todd's grandfather didn't sound the same. But it had been a long time ago, of course. "A hump? What hump?" "The little talk we had when Todd was having problems with his coursework back in ninth." "I'm not following you," the old man said slowly. "I would never presume to speak for Richard's son. It would cause trouble. Oh, you don't know how much trouble it would cause. You've made a mistake, young fella." "But, some sort of mistake. Got me confused with another student and another grandfather, I imagine." Ed was moderately thunderstruck. For one of the few times in his life he could not think of a single thing to say. If there was confusion, it sure wasn't on his part. "Well," Bowden said doubtfully, "it was nice of you to call, Mr.—" Ed found his tongue. "I'm right here in town, Mr. Bowden. It's a convention, guidance counselors. I'll be done around 10 tomorrow morning after the final paper is read. Could I come around to, he consulted the phone book again, to Ridge Lane and see you for a few minutes?" "What in the world for?" "Just curiosity, I guess. It's all water over the dam now. But about 3 years ago, Todd got himself into a real crack with his grades. They were so bad I had to send a letter home with his report card requesting a conference with a parent, or ideally with both of his parents. What I got was his grandfather, a very pleasant man named Victor Bowden." "But I've already told you—" "Yes, I know. Just the same, I talked to somebody claiming to be Todd's grandfather. It doesn't matter much now, I suppose, but seeing is believing. I'd only take a few minutes of your time, but it's all I can take, because I'm expected home by supper time." "Time is all I have," Bowden said a bit ruefully. "I'll be here all day. You're welcome to stop in." Ed thanked him, said goodbye, and hung up. He sat on the end of the bed, staring thoughtfully at the telephone. After a while, he got up and took a pack of Phillies cheroots from the sport coat hanging on the back of the desk chair. He ought to go. There was a workshop, and if he wasn't there, he would be missed. He lit his cheroot with a Holiday Inn match and dropped the burnt stub into a Holiday Inn ashtray. He went to the Holiday Inn window and looked blankly out into the Holiday Inn courtyard. It doesn't matter much now, he had told Bowden, but it mattered to him. He wasn't used to being sold a bill of goods by one of his kids, and this unexpected news upset him. Technically, he supposed, it could still turn out to be a case of an old man's senility, but Victor Bowden hadn't sounded as if he was drooling in his beard yet. And damn it, he didn't sound the same. Had Todd Bowden jobbed him? He decided it could have been done, theoretically at least, especially by a bright boy like Todd. He could have jobbed everyone, not just Ed French. He could have forged his mother or father's name to the flunk cards he had been issued during his bad patch. Lots of kids discovered a latent forging ability when they got flunk cards. He could have used Ink Eradicator on his second and third quarter reports, changing the grades up for his parents and then back down again so that his homeroom teacher wouldn't notice anything weird if he or she glanced at his card. The double application of Eradicator would be visible to someone who was really looking, but homeroom teachers carried an average of 60 students each. They were lucky if they could get the entire roll called before the first bell, let alone spot-checking returned cards for tampering. As for Todd's final class standing, it would have dipped by perhaps no more than 3 points overall. 2 bad marking periods out of a total of 12. His other grades had been lopsidedly good enough to make up most of the difference. And how many parents drop by the school to look at the student records kept by the California Department of Education, especially the parents of a bright student like Todd Bowden? Frown lines appeared on Ed French's normally smooth forehead. It doesn't matter much now. That was nothing but the truth. Todd's high school work had been exemplary. There was no way in the world you could fake a 94%. The boy was going on to Berkeley, the newspaper article had said, and Ed supposed his folks were damn proud, as they had every right to be. More and more it seemed to Ed that there was a vicious downside of American life, a greased skid of opportunism, cut corners, easy drugs, easy sex, a morality that grew cloudier each year. When your kid got through in standout style, parents had a right to be proud. It doesn't matter much now. But who was his frigging grandfather? That kept sticking into him. Who indeed? Had Todd Bowden gone to the local branch of the Screen Actors Guild and hung a notice on the bulletin board? Young man in grades trouble needs older man pref 70-80 years to give boffo performance as grandfather will pay union scale? Uh-uh. No way, Jose. And just what sort of adult would have fallen in with such a crazy conspiracy, and for what reason? Ed French, a.k.a. Pucker, a.k.a. Rubber Ed, just didn't know. And because it didn't really matter, he stubbed out his cheroot and went to his workshop. But his attention kept wandering. The next day he drove out to Ridge Lane and had a long talk with Victor Bowden. They discussed grapes, and discussed the retail grocery business and how the big chain stores were pushing the little guys out. They discussed the political climate in Southern California. Mr. Bowden offered Ed a glass of wine. Ed accepted with pleasure. He felt that he needed a glass of wine, even if it was only 10:40 in the morning. Victor Bowden looked as much like Peter Wimsey as a machine gun looks like a shillelagh. Victor Bowden had no trace of the faint accent Ed remembered, and he was quite fat. The man who had purported to be Todd's grandfather had been whip-thin. Before leaving, Ed told him, "I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't mention any of this to Mr. or Mrs. Bowden. There may be a perfectly reasonable explanation for all of it, and even if there isn't, it's all in the past." "Sometimes," Bowden said, holding his glass of wine up to the sun and admiring its rich, dark color, "the past don't rest so easy. Why else do people study history?" Ed smiled uneasily and said nothing. "But don't you worry, I never meddle in Richard's affairs. And Todd is a good boy, salutatorian of his class. He must be a good boy, am I right?" "As rain," Ed French said heartily, and then asked for another glass of wine. 23. Dusander's sleep was uneasy. He lay in a trench of bad dreams. They were breaking down the fence. Thousands, perhaps millions of them. They ran out of the jungle and threw themselves against the electrified barbed wire, and now it was beginning to lean ominously inward. Some of the strands had given way, and now coiled uneasily on the packed earth of the parade ground, squirting blue sparks. And still there was no end to them, no end. The Fuhrer was as mad as Rommel had claimed if he thought now, if he had ever thought there could be a final solution to this problem. There were billions of them. They filled the universe, and they were all after him. "Old man, wake up, old man. Dusander, wake up, old man, wake up." At first he thought this was the voice of the dream. Spoken in German, it had to be part of the dream. That was why the voice was so terrifying, of course. If he awoke, he would escape it, so he swam upward. The man was sitting by his bed, on a chair that had been turned around backwards. A real man. "Wake up, old man," this visitor was saying. He was young, no more than 30. His eyes were dark and studious behind plain steel-framed glasses. His brown hair was longish, collar length, and for a confused moment Dusander thought it was the boy in a disguise. But this was not the boy, wearing a rather old-fashioned blue suit much too hot for the California climate. There was a small silver pin on the lapel of the suit, silver the metal you use to kill vampires and werewolves. It was a Jewish star. "Are you speaking to me?" Dusunda asked in German. "Who else? Your roommate is gone."
"Heisel?"
"Yes, he went home yesterday." "Are you awake now?"
"Of course. But you've apparently mistaken me for someone else. My name is Arthur Denker. Perhaps you have the wrong room."
"My name is Weisskopf, and yours is Kurt Dusander." Dusander wanted to lick his lips, but didn't. Just possibly this was still all part of the dream, a new phase, no more. "Bring me a wino and a steak knife, Mr. Jewish Star, in the lapel, and I'll blow you away like smoke."
"I know no Dusander," he told the young man. "I don't understand you. Shall I ring for the nurse?"
"You understand," Weisskopf said. He shifted position slightly and brushed a lock of hair from his forehead. The prosiness of this gesture dispelled Dusander's last hope.
"Heisel," Weisskopf said, and pointed at the empty bed. "Heisel, Dusander, Weisskopf, none of these names mean anything to me."
"Heisel fell off a ladder while he was nailing a new gutter onto the side of his house," Weisskopf said. "He broke his back. He may never walk again. Unfortunate. But that was not the only tragedy of his life. He was an inmate of Patin, where he lost his wife and daughters. Patin, which you commanded."
"I think you are insane," Dusander said. "My name is Arthur Denker. I came to this country when my wife died. Before that, I was..."
"Spare me your tale," Weisskopf said, raising a hand. He had not forgotten your face. This face. Weisskopf flicked a photograph into Dusander's face like a magician doing a trick. It was one of those the boy had shown him years ago, a young Dusander in a jauntily cocked SS cap, seated behind his desk. Dusander spoke slowly, in English now, enunciating carefully. "During the war, I was a factory machinist. My job was to oversee the manufacture of drive columns and power trains for armored cars and trucks. Later, I helped to build Tiger tanks. My reserve unit was called up during the Battle of Berlin, and I fought honorably, if briefly. After the war, I worked in Essen, at the Menschler Motorworks, until it became necessary for you to run away to South America. With your gold that had been melted down from Jewish teeth, and your silver melted down from Jewish jewelry and your numbered Swiss bank account. Mr. Heisel went home a happy man, you know. Oh, he had a bad moment when he woke up in the dark and realized with whom he was sharing a room. But he feels better now. He feels that God allowed him the sublime privilege of breaking his back so that he could be instrumental in the capture of one of the greatest butchers of human beings ever to live." Dusander spoke slowly, enunciating carefully. "During the war, I was a factory machinist."
"Oh, why not drop it? Your papers will not stand up to a serious examination. I know it, and you know it. You are found out." "My job was to oversee the manufacture of corpses." "One way or another, you will be in Tel Aviv before the new year. The authorities are cooperating with us this time, Dusander. The Americans want to make us happy, and you are one of the things that will make us happy." "The manufacture of drive columns and power trains for armored cars and trucks. Later, I helped to build Tiger tanks."
"Why be tiresome? Why drag it out?"
"My reserve unit was called up."
"Very well, then. You'll see me again. Soon." Weisskopf rose. He left the room. For a moment his shadow bobbed on the wall, and then that was gone too. Dusander closed his eyes. He wondered if Weisskopf could be telling the truth about American cooperation. 3 years ago, when oil was tight in America, he wouldn't have believed it. But the current upheaval in Iran might well harden American support for Israel. It was possible. And what did it matter? One way or the other, legal or illegal, Weisskopf and his colleagues would have him. On the subject of Nazis, they were intransigent, and on the subject of the camps, they were lunatics. He was trembling all over, but he knew what he must do now. 24. The school records for the pupils who had passed through Santo Donato Junior High were kept in an old rambling warehouse on the north side. It was not far from the abandoned train yard. It was dark and echoing, and it smelled of wax and polish and 999 industrial cleaner. It was also the school department's custodial warehouse. Ed French got there around 4 PM, with Norma in tow. A janitor let them in, told Ed what he wanted was on the 4th floor, and showed them to a creeping, clanking elevator that frightened Norma into an uncharacteristic silence. She regained herself on the 4th floor, prancing and capering up and down the dim aisles of stacked boxes and files, while Ed searched for and eventually found the files containing report cards from 1975. He pulled the 2nd box and began to leaf through the B's. Bork, Bostwick, Boswell, Bowden, Todd. He pulled the card, shook his head impatiently over it in the dim light, and took it across to one of the high, dusty windows. "Don't run around in here, honey," he called over his shoulder.
"Why, Daddy?"
"Because the trolls will get you," he said, and held Todd's card up to the light. He saw it at once. This report card in those files for 3 years now had been carefully, almost professionally, doctored. "Jesus Christ," Ed French muttered.
"Trolls! Trolls! Trolls!"
Norma sang gleefully as she continued to dance up and down the aisles. 25. Dusander walked carefully down the hospital corridor. He was still a bit unsteady on his legs. He was wearing his blue bathrobe over his white hospital johnny. It was night now, just after 8 o'clock, and the nurses were changing shifts. The next half hour would be confused. He had observed that all the shift changes were confused. It was a time for exchanging notes, gossip, and drinking coffee at the nurses' station, which was just around the corner from the drinking fountain. What he wanted was just across from the drinking fountain. He was not noticed in the wide hallway, which at this hour reminded him of a long and echoing train station minutes before a passenger train departs. The walking wounded paraded slowly up and down, some dressed in robes as he was, others holding the backs of their johnnies together. Disconnected music came from 6 transistor radios in 6 different rooms. Visitors came and went. A man laughed in one room, and another man seemed to be weeping across the hall. A doctor walked by, with his nose in a paperback novel. Dusander went to the fountain, got a drink, wiped his mouth with his cupped hand, and looked at the closed door across the hall. This door was always locked. At least that was the theory. In practice, he had observed that it was sometimes both unlocked and unattended. Most often during the chaotic half-hour when the shifts were changing and the nurses were gathered around the corner. Dusander had observed all of this with the trained and wary eye of a man who has been on the jump for a long, long time. He only wished he could observe the unmarked door for another week or so, looking for dangerous breaks in the pattern. He would only have the one chance. But he didn't have another week. His status as werewolf in residence might not become known for another 2 or 3 days, but it might happen tomorrow. He did not dare wait. When it came out, he would be watched constantly. He took another small drink, wiped his mouth again, and looked both ways. Then, casually, with no effort at concealment, he stepped across the hall, turned the knob, and walked into the drug closet. If the woman in charge had happened to already be behind her desk, he was only near-sighted Mr. Denker. "So sorry, Mr. Heisel." On the table between the beds was a glass and a plastic pitcher filled with water. Pity there was no bourbon, really, it was a shame. But the pills would float him off just as nicely, no matter how they were washed down. "Morris Heisel, salud," he said with a faint smile, and poured himself a glass of water. After all those years of jumping at shadows, of seeing faces that looked familiar on park benches or in restaurants or bus terminals, he had finally been recognized and turned in by a man he wouldn't have known from Adam. It was almost funny. He had barely spared Heisel 2 glances. Heisel and his broken back from God. On second thought, it wasn't almost funny, it was very funny. He put 3 pills in his mouth, swallowed them with water, took 3 more, and then 3 more. In the room across the hall, he could see 2 old men hunched over a night table, playing a grumpy game of cribbage. One of them had a hernia, Dusander knew. What was the other? Gallstones? Kidney stones? Tumor, prostate, the horrors of old age. They were legion. He refilled his water glass but didn't take any more pills right away. Too many could defeat his purpose. He might throw them up, and they would pump the residue out of his stomach, saving him for whatever indignities the Americans and the Israelis could devise. He had no intention of trying to take his life stupidly, like a Hausfrau on a crying jag. When he began to get drowsy, he would take a few more. That would be fine. The quavering voice of one of the cribbage players came to him, thin and triumphant. "A double run of 3 for 8, 15s for 12, and the right jack for 13. How do you like those apples?" "Don't worry," the old man with the hernia said confidently. "I got first count. I'll peg out." Peg out, Dusander thought. Sleepy now. An apt enough phrase, but the Americans had a turn for idiom. "I don't give a tin shit. Get hip or get out. Stick it where the sun don't shine. Money talks. Nobody walks." Wonderful idiom. They thought they had him, but he was going to peg out before their very eyes. He found himself wishing, of all absurd things, that he could leave a note for the boy, wishing he could tell him to be very careful, to listen to an old man who had finally overstepped himself. He wished he could tell the boy that in the end he, Dusander, had come to respect him, even if he could never like him, and that talking to him had been better than listening to the run of his own thoughts. But any note, no matter how innocent, might cast suspicion on the boy, and Dusander did not want that. Oh, he would have a bad month or two waiting for some government agent to show up and question him about a certain document that had been found in a safety deposit box rented to Kurt Dusander, a.k.a. Arthur Denker. But after a time, the boy would come to believe he had been telling the truth. There was no need for the boy to be touched by any of this as long as he kept his head. Dusander reached out with a hand that seemed to stretch for miles, got the glass of water, and took another 3 pills. He put the glass back, closed his eyes, and settled deeper into his soft, soft pillow. He had never felt so much like sleeping, and his sleep would be long. It would be restful, unless there were dreams. The thought shocked him. Dreams? Please, God, no. Not those dreams. Not for eternity. Not with all possibility of awakening gone. Not in sudden terror he tried to struggle awake. It seemed that hands were reaching eagerly up out of the bed to grab him. Hands with hungry fingers. No! His thoughts broke up in a steepening spiral of darkness, and he rode down that spiral as if down a greased slide, down and down to whatever dreams there are. His overdose was discovered at 1:35 a.m., and he was pronounced dead 15 minutes later. The nurse on duty was young and had been susceptible to elderly Mr. Denker's slightly ironic courtliness. She burst into tears. She was a Catholic, and she could not understand why such a sweet old man, who had been getting better, would want to do such a thing and damn his immortal soul to hell.